Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by my co-host Gail Schimmel.
Hello everyone.
Gail, how has your writing week been?
Fiona, I'm having the trouble that you were having last week. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a busy time on the writer's calendar, as people listening will hear from what our guests talk about. We are recording this in the Kingsmead Franschhoek season. Mm-hmm. And even though I didn't go to Franschhoek, so I don't have that excuse, I have come back from holiday, pile of work on my desk, pile of reading to do for Kingsmead, a book coming out, and I'm not getting to it. After that wonderful holiday writing, mm-hmm. which I thought would last forever, I'm not getting to it again. I'm worried about it. I'm stressed about it, but I'm trying to be kind to myself and allow that maybe this month it's not going to happen.
Right. Yes.
Tell me you've had a better time.
I have, in the sense of I'm still making the words. I'm still doing it. But I think because I have been so distracted, it's starting to feel a little bit mechanical. And every now and again, I look back on stuff I've written and I realize that I left myself a whole plot point there that I fully intended to pursue and then forgot all about. So that is a sign that I'm distracted, that I'm not seeing beyond the 300 or 400 words that I'm writing right at that moment, and that I really need to get back into the flow. I need to rediscover the love of it and the impetus of the story, because at the moment, all I'm really doing is just putting words on the page.
But Fiona, isn't that how it is when one is a full-time working writer? You know, doctors don't love every moment of being a doctor. Lawyers, I can promise you, do not love every moment of being a lawyer. When it's your job to write, it's not going to be a joy every minute.
That's true. But even when the doctor's having a bad day and not loving his job, he's hopefully still doing it as well as he would when he is loving it. And I feel as though I'm not really doing it as well as I would be if I were in that phase of loving it. So I need to get back into that just to make it good again.
I'm going to bet you that when you read back at the end of it, you're not going to know which you wrote in the good phase and which you wrote in the bad phase. Fiona, what have you been reading, consuming, watching to help you through this bad patch?
Well, I and the rest of the world have been watching Baby Reindeer, which was the series created by the Scottish writer and comedian Richard Gadd about his experience of being stalked over several years by a woman that he encountered in a bar. And the whole story has blown up because now a person saying that she is that woman has come forward and done interviews, and it's just been dominating headlines. But as an act of storytelling, it was truly masterly. And he did what he set out to do, which was to create a story where there are no clear goodies and baddies, where everybody is complex, everybody behaves badly from time to time. And he's so brave and so honest because he shows himself behaving badly and making poor decisions. There are times when you're really tearing your hair out and thinking, no, don't do that. You will regret it. You're going to be sorry. And then he is sorry. And some people have got so frustrated with him that they've just given up on it. But for me, I couldn't look away. It was so interesting. And at some point he explains why he was in that kind of state of paralysis and not really valuing himself enough to step away. Something bad had happened to him and he explains it. I just loved every moment of it. I thought it was absolutely masterful.
I started watching it and then I read a bit about what was waiting for me in the story, and I'm not up to the abuse at the moment, so I decided to stop watching. But I still read all the articles about it with absolute, like, gripped by it.
What have you been reading or watching or listening to?
So I've had a very interesting experience, and I think it's actually a particularly interesting read in the context of our guest today. I had to reread to help my son with his schoolwork, A Thousand Splendid Sons by, now I'm going to go blank, Khalid Hosseini. And I read it when it came out 20, 25 years ago. And it's a magnificent book. Mm. It's set in Afghanistan. It is about the lives of women in Afghanistan. It is very much about education of women in Afghanistan, which is a huge problem. Afghanistan under the Taliban, women were not allowed to work. They were not allowed to be educated. And while it is undoubtedly what would be classed as a literary novel, mm-hmm. he still does the genre thing. Short chapters, ending on a cliffhanger, sometimes playing with the reader. A gun is held to her head, and then the gun is a water pistol. Mm. You know, and he uses those techniques of the genre writer to keep you gripped. But it's also interesting because it ends on a note of optimism for Afghanistan. Because at the time he was writing, Afghanistan had entered a time of optimism. Mm. And now reading it, however many years later, that time of optimism is over. America left Afghanistan and the Taliban came back, and women's rights in Afghanistan are worse than anywhere else in the world. I read something that it is the only country in the world where women do not have the right to secondary education. I was lucky enough last year to go to a talk by Malala, a live talk, the Nelson Mandela Memorial Lecture last year. Mm-hmm. And she said, we are forgetting the women of Afghanistan and they are in trouble and we are forgetting them. Please do not forget them. And reading this book again and remembering all this stuff, it's a powerful read.
I can well believe it. Well, our guest today is someone who does write women's stories. She's also a literary writer who uses the techniques of genre to keep you gripped, and we're looking forward to hearing from her. Our guest today is Shabnam Khan. Shabnam is a novelist and essay writer. Shabnam is the author of Onion Tears, which she wrote, unbelievably enough, at the age of 25. It was published in 2011 and has recently been re-released, which I'm very happy about. She's also the author of a collection of essays called How I Accidentally Became a Global Stock Photo. She's the author of The Modern Love Story, another favorite of mine from the New York Times, called From a Sale, Lace Undergarments Never Worn. And most recently, Shabnam is the author of the novel The Lost Love of Akbar Manzil, published by Pan Macmillan and recently released. Hi, Shabnam. Thank you for your time and welcome.
Hi, Fiona. Thanks so much for having me here.
Shabnam, we're going to jump right in, as always, and ask you, how was your writing week?
My writing week was not too much of a writing week because I'm in the middle of book tour, so I just came from the Franschhoek Literary Festival. I've had some book launches in Cape Town and now in Johannesburg, and then I'm taking part in Kingsmead. So I haven't had too much time to write, but I've been trying to read.
And when you are in the midst of a book project, what does your writing day look like?
I mean, in an ideal world, I would love to be able to just be able to work throughout the whole morning. So like before the day can attack you with all its to-do lists and things to do and just life admin. But I'm not achieving that lately. I'm just like taking over with life admin from the time I wake up. So I'm not doing an ideal writing schedule right now, but in an ideal world, that is what I would love to do, to be able to wake up really early, get some exercise in, and then just write to my heart's content. But as you all know, it doesn't always end up that way.
And how many words a day would you aim for to feel satisfied?
It's very strange because the next project I'm working on is not a novel. It's something nonfiction, mm-hmm. and it works in like sputters and spurts, if I can explain it that way. So I don't have a word count because it's not a novel. You know, with a novel, I feel you can go as long and hard as you want. And then later on when you edit, you cut out and see where you want the story to go. But this is a strange project. So it's something new that I'm trying. And I don't know. I need to find how to work through it. I'm not going to put a word count on this because It's more about going back and tweaking, going back and tweaking, tweaking, then going forward a few steps and going back again. It's a strange one. There's no word count for it, but I do need to set hours, like a certain amount of hours at least a day that I need to work on it. Yeah.
I'm very interested that you've just said with a novel, you go back and you cut words. Are you a big write too much and then cut it down to size, or write exactly the amount of words you need?
I thought all writers were like that, where you write too much and then you go back and cut. Oh, you write exactly to size.
I don't.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I'm too lazy to do that.
That's why I think it takes me so long to write, because I just write whatever feels good. And then a lot of the work comes in coming back in editing it and trying to make it make sense and trying to make it flow and trying to see where it's the strongest. And so, yeah, I'm a big advocate of that. Yeah.
And those words, do you keep them somewhere safe and precious for yourself, or do you just cut them out and throw them away and kill your darlings?
I cut what I think needs to be cut, but I also trust that my editor is going to cut more than what I want to cut. So I'm waiting for the editor to say cut a lot. Like with my latest novel, the editor cut so much more than I had cut. So I had cut a lot, and then she went even more deeper and cut even more. So I think I don't cut enough.
Very interesting.
Do you enjoy the process of being edited? Is it rewarding for you?
I think as a writer, you feel hurt when things that you love are taken off the page. But I think later on, when I'm looking at it, I can't even remember what was missing from there. And I appreciate that it reads better now. Mm-hmm. So in the moment, I don't like it. But later on, I appreciate it, yeah.
Very interesting. Tell us a little bit about how you came to be a writer. Were you one of those people that was the only thing you ever wanted to be? Or did you veer off into trying to have another career?
Gail, that's an interesting question. I think it was a dream in the back of my mind that I could be a writer, because I loved reading from little. My grandfather would tell me stories. My sister would take me to the library. I loved storytelling. And I was, you know, in the back of your mind, the ultimate dream is like to be a writer. But it's also like, I think that little girl dream, like to be a ballerina or to be, you know, so you think yes, but you also think maybe it's not realistic. As you get older, you think it's not realistic, like I need to do a more realistic thing. And so I had it in the back of my mind. I always say, yes, I did dream of it, but I didn't think it was practical. And so like as time got by, I was like, oh, what am I going to study? What am I going to do? And I didn't know what I wanted to study. I did like a few weeks of architecture. I left that. I did 1 year of fine art. I left that. And I finally did like an English and media studies degree, just because I needed to do something and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And indirectly, that English degree took me to my master's in creative writing, which then led me to my novel. So it did lead me in an indirect way into writing, but I didn't do it purposefully. It kind of like happened. Yeah.
I think I mentioned to you when we ran into each other at Franschhoek that when I read Onion Tears, I felt the same way as I did when I read Zadie Smith's White Teeth for the first time, just blown away by this extraordinary novel, and also with the thought in the back of my mind that it had been written by a 25-year-old, and how was that even possible? So can you talk us a little bit through the process of writing that first novel? Did it come out in a gush, or was it very much an arduous process to get it out? There's so much I want to ask you about Onion Tears, but just the initial process, where it was part of your MA, was it?
Yes. So, I mean, firstly, thank you for those kind words, Fiona. It was for my MA. So it was my dissertation. Onion Tears was my dissertation for my master's, and it was done under Corbis Moman, the poet, who was, you know, so different from the life that I had been growing up in. If I think about that time, because I wrote it, it was published when I was 25, but I wrote it like when I was 23, 24, because it was over 2 years. And if I think about that, like my life was changing, like anybody's worldview is changing. You're stepping into the world, you're meeting new people. You know, I had come from a very like small Indian Muslim community, and I always thought the world was one way. And then you get to university and you meet new people, and then, you know, you get the supervisor like Corbis, who is an Afrikaner man from Pietermaritzburg, and he was teaching us, and I was getting into that worldview also, and he was exposing me to books that I hadn't read before and I wouldn't have read normally. So that influenced me also. And he was always, as a mentor, pushing me to write more than I more than I thought it was possible, you know, as in pushing the ways that I could write. And I think also just any mentor who exposes you to different forms of writing is doing you a favor because they're showing you what is possible. So I think I was experimenting a lot at that time when I was doing Onion Tears. I mean, you've read both the books. They're very different books. And I think that was the stage I was in my life at that point, trying to write like about an Indian Muslim family in Johannesburg, just trying to get through life, just trying to figure out their way as three different generations of women. And I mean, I think that's what I was trying to do then. And I always think for me, personally, it's who you are as a person who influences what you're writing. And that point was so integral, 23, 24, becoming a different person influences what you're writing at the time also.
Do you look back and feel amazed that you managed that so young? Or does it feel like anybody who puts their mind to it and can write should be able to write at 24, write a great book at 24?
Oh, it's a tough question because I'm seeing writers are like really young nowadays and doing stuff. Like, I'm shocked. You know, R.F. Kuang was Rooney, like, and she was 19 when she did The Poppy Wars. And I'm just like, I used to think that was a big achievement, but now I look at these authors and I'm like, I don't know. So I don't look back at it that way. And I also feel I had help. Like, I had a great mentor and I had someone behind me saying, you have deadlines. You need to finish this. You need to finish this. I really appreciate that now because I don't have that anymore. And it's part of the reason why it took me so long to write the second novel, because I needed someone pushing me and, trying to make my writing go further than it can. You know, I really benefited from that process now looking back on it. And that helped me and I had help. Like, I mean, that's also how I did it.
It's interesting to me that it was written at a time when you were starting to look outwards into the world and starting to be exposed to a greater world of literature, because it is a very specific community-based book, very much predicated on the details of daily life and the lives of these three generations of women. It's very domestic. It's wrought on a small scale. It's almost as though at that time when you were starting to look outward, you were also looking inward and writing this highly, highly specific community-based novel. Why do you think that was? What brought you to reflect so inwardly?
I mean, I guess as you start reading more books and also when you're at that age, I think for me personally, I realized that I could challenge certain things because now you're like, oh, I'm becoming an adult in the world. I can question things. I don't have to just listen and I don't have to just accept. And so part of writing the book was me looking at the community and also like also raising questions of like racism, classism, the patriarchy, you know, things I just had accepted for my whole life. But then I was at this age, I was like, oh, I can use this novel to think on my own about the things that are happening in my community and what does this mean for me? Like, what do I think about it? And then use the characters to explore my own ideas. I was like, oh, yeah, there's a lot of patriarchal things happening here. It's a lot of racism. There's, you know, my own questions were being brought up in the novel. And that's and the first place I would look is in my own community because it was, you know, they always say your first novel is write what you know. So,
I'm fascinated, by the way, you've written three very, very different books. And most writers, except for Fiona, find their genre and they write in their genre. And you experimenting, and from the sounds of things, you're now writing something completely different. Do you feel any pressure to choose a genre and stick with it, especially now that you've had this enormous success with your latest book?
I mean, the more people talk about it, and even like hearing you say it, I realize that I'm writing so differently between books. But as I said earlier, for me personally, it really is where you are in life that influences what I'm writing at the time. So for me at that time, I was exploring community. And then, you know, with how I accidentally became a global stock photo, it was more about me taking that idea further, but like trying to be brave and go out in the world and do things and have experiences. And then Lost Love of Akbar Manzil for me was I came into a place in my life where I feel more confident, more happy, more settled with who I am. I did all that searching in the first two books. And now I'm like, okay, I kind of know who I am. I can write more confidently. I like to talk about love. I like to talk about grief. I like to talk about horror. Let me put this all together in a book and make it a story. And then the next one is, again, because life is ups and downs, I'm more in like an uncertain part of my life now with things going on in my life. Anyway, we don't have to get into that. But you know, things are happening. Like my parents are getting older. I'm getting older. I haven't found like love in the way that I thought. And so now I'm having those thoughts about like, what does it mean for the next decade that's coming up? And so my writing is now going back into that uncertain phase, which again, I think shows on the project that I'm working on. So for me, I think it's my personal life very much influences the projects that I'm working on. Yeah.
But you are a young person, yes. And you do seem to have an affinity for writing about the elderly. In Onion Tears, in Akbar Manzil, in your modern love story, you write with incredible compassion and understanding about the elderly. Where does that come from? Is it a connection you've always felt?
That's so astute, Fiona. Thank you. Because they are always characters in my novel and they're always older. And it is because I've been surrounded by older people my whole life. My grandfather lived with me in our house until like 94. So I had the pleasure of like being with him, listening to his stories, having him come in the house every day. And then my aunt came and moved in our house as well. And she was paraplegic and she had her two kids. And so I've just been surrounded by like older people who sometimes need help. Mm-hmm. And now as I'm getting older, I've been living with my parents my whole life. So I've been watching them getting older, becoming the people who are looking after me. And then slowly I'm becoming the people who are looking after them. Mm. Can see how time goes by and how age goes by. So I'm very like, I do think I'm very conscious of it. Like even, I don't know if I'm on the street or something, I can see who might need help where, because I'm so conscious with my parents. I know I need to speak louder if my father can't hear properly, or if, you know, I'm just always reminding them to drink water and sleep early and do your steps. And every time I phone now, even while I'm on book tour, I'm like, did he drink water? Did you make him drink water? Did he take his tablets? I don't know. When you live with people who are getting older, you're just constantly conscious of like, what maybe do they need? Mm. And I think in my writing, then I'm just constantly conscious of like, I don't know, like it hurts when you walk up the stairs, like you can see somebody's knees are sore when they're walking up the stairs, or like what, and not that I'm a very helpful person, but you just become conscious because especially as a writer, you're watching all the time. So you're seeing small things. And I see it also like when family come home, my sisters come home and they think my parents are the same age they were when they left the house. Mm. And I'm like, they can't do those things anymore. We need to remember, because I'm seeing time going by, which I think people miss, and I'm watching it happen in front of my eyes. So I think that's where it comes from.
A lot of young people look at the elderly and have a kind of, oh, shame. Oh, they're so cute. They're so sweet, et cetera. Yes, exactly. Kind of attitude. But your elderly characters are very fully, vividly rendered on the page. They have a full, strong emotional life. Have you never felt that, oh, shame kind of attitude for the elderly?
I mean, no, why? No, why? Because they're me in a few years. They're all of us in a few years. If we can't think that our lives are not going to be full when we're older, it's a very dismissive attitude to say, like, oh, shame, because we're all going to end up there. Mm. And I wouldn't want somebody to be saying, oh, shame to my life, because I've lived a full life and I would want to hope to be trying to live the best that I can when I'm older. You know, I always think when I meet people now, especially like as I'm getting older, I'm like, even if they're dismissive of me or whatever, I'm like, time is a great humbler. Mm. It is the great humbling thing of life. So no, we shouldn't.
You've had a breakout novel, as we all promised at the third novel, and not all of us get. And you've written about your road to publication. Can you tell us a little bit about that story? How did you manage it? How did you get the international deal? How horrible was it along the way?
Yeah, I mean, it is a strange story. I was trying to get a literary agent, which is not a thing we talk about in South Africa. It's not an industry here. And I was doing a lot of research. I had like an Excel sheet with color-coded Excel sheets of places I wanted to apply to. And I did a lot of research because even though I had a master's in creative writing, no one tells us about literary agents. And so I would go onto Twitter and read about like, how do you get one? Did a lot of research, started applying to a lot of agents. And as any South African or African agent will tell you, it's very hard to get an agent. I don't know if they think our stories are not going to sell or I don't know, but you know, I got rejected by a lot of agents and I would like keep putting red marks on my Excel sheet.
Was this after Onion Tears?
So it's after Onion Tears, even during and after Global Stock Photo.
Right. Got it.
Right. So I just kept getting rejected. And then, I saw a residency in the US, which I don't think anybody outside of the US would have applied for because there was no funding to get there, which is expensive. And I applied and I saw one of the things was if your manuscript is nearly finished, you can talk to an agent. So I thought this is ideal for me. But I got it, but then I had to get to the US. And so I remember I approached the city of Durban. I was like, please, this might change my career. Like, I'm a Durban author. You don't have many authors left in Durban. Like, this could really be good for me. And I didn't get any response from them. I applied to another institution who were going to fund the ticket. And then at the last minute was like, no, you should ask your father to fund the ticket.
Wow.
Because somebody found out because it was a community group that I had approached. And so somebody knew my father and they were like, you should ask him. And I was like, he's retired. I'm not going to ask him anyway. It was quite a story. And I remember, okay, I was going to use my savings. I was like, okay, because I was freelancing at the time. And I was like, okay, use your savings. It's fine. Go. This will be an investment in your future. Like, if you want to be serious about writing, then you got to do it. So I went, took the ticket, flew to New Mexico. I never, you know, it was like such a bizarre place. I was the only South African there. And I was like, okay, I'm going to sell my book. And so one of the days we had to pitch to the agent. There was a computer screen there. The agent was in New York and we had to pitch our story. And I thought, oh, I got this. And I went to the screen. And, you know, it's like the American pitch, the five-second pitch, or I don't know, give your best of this story. And when the time came, I got so stressed out that I'd flown all this way, I'd made all this effort, and my mind just went blank. And I just said, the book is about, and I stopped and I froze. And I said, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to say. And I just said, I'm so sorry, I have to go. I can't do this. And I went off and I just walked in the corner and I stood there and I cried and I cried and I cried. And the other authors, the other people at the residency were like, comforting me and saying like, we're so sorry, you know, da, da, da. And the whole day I was very upset. And cause I was like, I messed up my chance. I came here. I have to go back now. And it's not gonna, this was the opportunity at least for a face to screen conversation. And then that day we had to have a meeting with the mentor. There's a mentor at the residency and she helps you with your writing. And she had heard me reading and I just kept tearing up the whole time. And she said, you know, what's wrong? And I said, no, you know, I came all the way from South Africa. I really messed up my chance. And she said, maybe I can help you. And I said, I remember thinking like, how is she going to help me? It's fine. You know, and I was like, it's okay. And I went back to sleep. And the next morning when I woke up and I was so at my lowest of my low and I woke up in my inbox, there was like three literary agents from New York who were like, we heard about your amazing book from that mentor, the woman who I had seen. And, could you please send us the novel? We'd love to see it. And you just need that opportunity. You just need that door to open from somebody. And I was really at my lowest of my lowest. And the two of them didn't want it, but the one I had coffee with her and she liked it. And she was like, I think I can help you. Because the novel was very heavy at that point. There was just too much going on. It was really hard.
Was it Akbar Manzil?
Yes, it was. It was The Lost Love of Akbar Manzil. So finally, I went on with her. And then after like 2 years of working on the novel and back and forth and this and that, like she sold it at auction for like a six-figure deal in the US. It was amazing. And I remember thinking when I left, I'm making an investment in my future by doing this. So, it always reminds me and reminds me to tell people like that you have to bet on yourself because then you will see it later on, but you have to make the first attempt to do it. Because if I had said, oh, you know what, this ticket is too expensive, I'm not going to go, I'll just leave it. What's going to happen anyway? And it opened up doors for me in an unexpected way. So you have to like bet on yourself.
Wow, amazing story.
Yeah, it was crazy.
I suspect this is connected to the international deal, but why was the book released under a different title in America?
That's one because of my questions.
Sorry, Gail. It's The Lost Love of Akbar Manzil in South Africa, and it's The Gene Waits, is it 1,000 years?
100 years.
100 years in America. So who came up with those titles? Why was the decision made? Are you happy with it?
Yeah, the title was really, it was called Paper Flowers before.
Oh, that's so pretty.
Yes, I really loved it. My father liked this old Indian movie called Kagaz Ki Phool, which the meaning was paper flowers. It was an old Bollywood film about life from the 1950s. And I really wanted to name my next novel that because he liked it. And I would weave in the theme of paper flowers into the novel because I wanted that title. But at the last minute, the US publishers, the marketing team said they didn't think paper flowers was going to like cut it. Like people wouldn't pick it up in a hurry. And so at the last minute, we had to like think up titles, and we gave like the editor, me and the agent gave like, I don't know, a short list of five titles. And it took really long to try to think up titles. And they liked The Gin Waits 100 Years. I think because it's evocative. I think it works in the US market. People might pick it up in a hurry. People don't know too much about the gin. So they wanted that title. In South Africa, we, Pan Macmillan and I decided that gin is a very supernatural word. It might deter readers away from the book. Mm-hmm. And which we were correct because of the book, at the book launch, when I did a book launch, someone said, lucky you didn't put gin in the title because I wouldn't have bought the book.
Yeah, I wondered about that.
Yeah, so we changed it. And Lost Love of Akbar Manzil was on that short list of titles of the names we gave. And I think that one does get to the heart of the book. So that's why there's two different titles.
Are you going to tell us which one you prefer? I mean, there's an implication in what you just said.
I think I like Lost Love of Akbar Manzil. I think that one, well, I mean, I think it represents, look, I understand Gin Waits 100 Years is more evocative. But if you really want to get to what the heart of the novel is about, then I think The Lost Love of Akbar Manzil is telling you it's about this house.
Mm. Okay, I want to know now about writing magic, about how different it is from writing an unmagical novel, and how you set about creating that world of magic.
You know, I've never realized Onion Tears has no magic in it. Yes, they're two different novels. Oh my goodness. Yes, the one is very, okay. I think with Onion Tears, I was really going for a realistic novel about life. And then I think, again, it comes back to the personal. When I started living life, I realized there's magic in everything if you look for it. You know, like the strange story about the agent. Like, you've got to go run off and pursue your dreams if you want to make it happen. Even though sometimes it feels like it's not going to happen. And I realized magical things happen in real life, and that's part of real life. Like, there is fate for me, and there are signs for me, and there are small moments in the ordinary, you know? And so I think I really wanted to capture that in the novel, and it kept growing. So I would be like, there's going to be a djinn in the novel. And then the editor was like, but we need to make the djinn bigger, give it more like power, or like, you know. And I think I was just trying to write life like how it is, like it's like it, like it, you think it's normal, but there's magic in everything. And I was just elevating that through the djinn, elevating that through the dead sister, elevating that through objects that seem to think and talk, and the house that seems to be watching. I think I just used those things to tell you that life is more than what we see. It's magical.
Was it fun?
It was fun. It was fun to make the house alive, and to make, like, to wonder what are the smells thinking? what is the house thinking? What are the fingerprints on the wall thinking? You know, like, that was fun. It made writing pleasurable. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a quote from the book, something like, one character says, are ghosts real? And another says, they're as real as you want them to be, or as real as you believe them to be.
Exactly. It's that kind of thing. Even the sister, I didn't want to ever make readers know if she was real or not. Was she part of Sana's imagination? Because we all sometimes imagine things, you know, or was she actually a real character walking in the book? You know? Yeah.
So when you set out to write this novel, were you consciously writing a Gothic novel? Because it has so many elements of the Gothic. The house, which has life and agency, the sort of presence of something living in the attic, all the signs and signals, the dark past that starts seeping up into the present, the lost letters that Sana finds. So much of it is Gothic, and it's got elements of horror in it as well. Did you only realize afterwards how Gothic it was, or were you always writing towards that?
That's a great question, Fiona. I didn't know it was Gothic at all. I never knew it was Gothic until I finished it. And they were like, yeah, we'll market it as Gothic. And I was like, oh yes, it's very Gothic. There's a house on the, by the seaside. It's a haunted house. You know, there's unease in this house. There's a tragic love story. It fulfilled all the Gothic elements, but I didn't think at all it was Gothic. I just thought I was writing like a scary story. And I now see how well it fits into Gothic. But I didn't know that at all when I was writing it. I didn't even sell it as that when I was pitching it. I didn't think of it that way.
Daphne Du Maurier in Durban.
Yeah, exactly. But I didn't think of it that way. I needed someone else to see it and tell me.
And are you feeling a pressure with you've had this big American deal? Are you feeling a pressure that now you've got to produce another big American deal book? Or are you kind enough to yourself to not put that pressure on yourself?
I think I was very lucky, extremely lucky, unexpected surprise of my life. So
talented.
And yes. Talented, yeah. But I mean, talent and luck is, it always takes talent and luck. So I don't feel pressure to do another big American book. I mean, and I don't even know if it, you know, the pressure more is like, oh, will it fulfill that, expectation on it more than anything? You know, I'm not even thinking about the next one. I'm thinking about this one. Like, will it fulfill the expectation on it? So no, not at the moment.
Has it gone on sale in America?
It's on sale in America. It's been critically reviewed well.
Okay.
You know, I saw that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, it's not a bestseller or anything.
Is it absolutely nerve-wracking?
Just before it came out, yes. Anyway, but I mean, even in South Africa, it's just, you don't know what's going to happen. And it's also because it's a strange book. It's not, doesn't fit into categories very quickly. It's hard to see. And then in America, it was like, this is a South African Indian Muslim community you're looking at. It's such a specific community. I don't know how people are going to receive that. So somebody was like, are you looking at your sales figures every day in the US? Because you can check every week.
Yeah.
And I was like, never. I didn't look for the first 3 months. I was like, no, I'm not going to look at it. I don't want to make myself unnecessarily afraid or scared. If something good is happening, somebody's going to tell me. And if something bad is happening, well, I don't need to know. So
I do want to ask about your collection of essays, How I Accidentally Became a Global Stock Photo. They together form a kind of a memoir of a time in your life. How many of them were already written when you decided to collect them? How many of them did you purpose write for the collection? And how did you decide sort of how to structure it so it had that memoir-like quality?
You know, it actually was created from my Twitter stories. So I would share the stories on Twitter and people would really enjoy them and like share them, and Andrea at Penn Macmillan saw it and was like, we should put this together in a collection of stories for people to read. And so I had to look at those tweets and then think, how do I expand on them? Because a tweet is a very specific size. You have to get to the punchline really quickly. There was just a very way of format of me telling the stories, and I only knew how to tell them on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So I had to learn how to expand them. And I realized when I was writing them, I couldn't tell them just these. I just thought it was a collection of funny stories. And as I was writing it, I realized I have to tell you who I am for you to get more from these stories than just the way I tweeted them. So we then, Andrea said, go back to your childhood also. Mm-hmm. Like, look at stories from then when you were young. So there's a section called childhood, which I start telling almost these like funny little excerpts from my life, funny little moments I remember, or significant moments from like learning how to read and, you know, just having sisters and how it was so wonderful to have sisters being around me, and being the fourth daughter in an Indian family, which was shameful at the time, you know, because so many girls in a family, we are the boys. And so she encouraged the structure of the novel. Like she said, go back into childhood. And then when I went back to childhood, that gave me the stepping stone. I was like, okay, I'm telling you the story of my life, actually. I'm not just telling you a collection of funny stories. I'm telling you about how it means to be a girl in the world and to dream and then want to follow those dreams and then to be told, like, you're not allowed to travel by yourself. You're not allowed to do these things. And then to still, like, try to pursue. Like, the first time I traveled alone was to go live in Kashmir in a village in the Himalayas. Like, and I was so scared. I was so scared. Like, a lot of the book is just about being scared, like being so scared, but trying to go beyond that. And then the benefits that people will reap if you try to go beyond what you're afraid of. And so the structure came out of realizing that I'm telling a life story. And there were some stories that I didn't share on Twitter that I would later think about and realize it wouldn't make a good tweet, but it would make a good story in a book. And so then I would add that. And so we added more, and we added more life story to that. And that's how we kind of got that structure of that book.
It started with Twitter, and I'm very interested in, especially because you are, as we might have brushed against, a little bit younger than Fiona and I. So, so you've almost come into writing with social media already part of the writer's life. How do you work with social media to promote yourself? What role does it play in your writing life?
I don't do social media in the sense that just to share my writing stuff, because my social media came first, I think. I do it because I'm single and I'm alone and I live with my parents in Durban. And so my only way of communicating with other people most of the time, because I don't like going out, is through social media. That's where I get to talk about whatever I'm feeling. So I have time and I also want to interact with people, but I'm also an introvert. So social media is an excellent way because I get to choose how I want to interact with people. I get to keep a little glass up there, but I also get to interact with people and hear back from them and tell them about my day. And it's, so me, it works in the best way possible. And that's why I use it. And that's why I enjoy it, because I still get to have human interaction, but I still get to have my space.
And favorite platform?
It used to be Twitter, but you know, this Ellen just messed it up now. He just messed it up, but I'm still there. And I'm more on Instagram now, I think, because it's just, there's more people now. It's where people that you interact with are at the time. So for me, it's now more Instagram, but I'm still on Twitter because I always remember, like, Twitter is a place where I made all my friends and where I made, like, a name for myself. And I remember that, like, it was, Twitter was very powerful when it was powerful. And I learned about the literary world and I met other writers and made friends. And so I'll never forget that. But yeah, now I'm more on Instagram. And I keep saying I'm old. I'm not old, but I think I'm too old for TikTok to learn it properly.
No, you're not. Let's talk about cooking, because it plays a big role in your writing. And I want to know what sort of a role it actually plays in your life. Are you the Khadija who makes everything from scratch and her life is cooking and flavors and smells? Or are you the Sumaya who buys everything store-bought? Or are you somewhere in between?
I don't like cooking so much. I'm not a... I remember reading a review once where they said, you can just see Khan is a great cook. And I laughed because I'm not. But I grew up with prolific cooks around me. So my mother had 7 older sisters.
You really are from a whole lot of women.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why my writing is always about women and food, because I grew up with all my mother talking to all her sisters about food, and they'd be talking about what are they cooking, or even on the phone. If the one is in another city and my mother's had sisters in other countries, so they're always on the phone talking to one another. And, oh, how much masala do you put? How much salt do you put? Do you need to put pepper? But get about 1 kg of leg of lamb. They're just talking about food all the time. And I also realized it's a love language. Like, talking about food is a love language to one another. They're basically just saying, I love you, I miss you, are you eating well, how are you eating, you know? And recipes are that kind of language. And so I just loved hearing them talking about food. I would hear, and then I have 3 older sisters also, so I also like just hear women around me, how they communicate, how they interact, how they fight. And through food. It's always done through food. So I kept hearing these descriptions of food. I kept eating amazing food because that's how my aunts would show their love. Like, a lot of my aunts didn't have much money, but the way that they would show food after they saw us for many months, like we would come to Johannesburg or to other cities where my mother's sisters, they're all scattered all over, was that they would try to force food. And even if they didn't have enough money for the food, they would make sure we get meat. I remember putting my plate underneath the table to try to hide the plate because she kept putting more rice and rice on my plate. And I'd be like, I can't eat more. I cannot, you know. So I was surrounded by food and love. And so that obviously spills over in the writing. Yeah.
It feels to me like you are part of two almost movements in South African writing. And the one is the voice of the Muslim woman, which it seems to be growing. And the other is the Durban writer. What do you think's going on with those two trends? Like, why is it me that I just was ignorant of it before? Or is there a growing trend in those two spaces?
I do think with the Muslim writers, there's definitely a lot of more Muslim writers coming out in South Africa. And I do think it's also because in these communities, it was often thought like to have a successful career, you had to be an accountant or a doctor or, you know, or a career where you could earn a living, because also if there wasn't enough money in the family, then you just needed to have a stable job. Stop thinking about dreaming things like writing books and poetry. But I do think increasingly as time is going by, and this is in many communities, not only like in the Muslim community, we're seeing that it's a viable career, that you can actually do something with it, that you can actually, and that it's the importance of telling our own stories. You know, if you don't tell your story, someone else is going to tell your story for you. So it's up to people within their own communities to talk about the food that you cook and the families and the fights and the class things within your own community as well. You know, the problems within your own community as well as the wonderful things.
Do you think that women's rights come in there, that women are encouraged to express themselves more than they used to be within the community?
I mean, yes, I think so. That as well as also, like, I would like to think, like, even Onion Tears, which was now 13 years ago, encourage other young women to, like, be like, oh, we can tell our stories and people will read our stories, you know, and that there's importance in telling those stories. So I think the more as time passes, it's happening because people are seeing that our people can write and that they can do it and then they can publish and can make a career out of it. And I was encouraged also in my time by like writers like Betty Govinden and Ronnie Govinder. I would see them come to our schools and talk and I would be like, oh, it's actually a career. I can actually do it. I mean, not even a career, but like I can actually write a book. It can happen. So the more you see it, the more it will happen. And so I think that's why we're seeing more Muslim writers, much more coming out with stories in South Africa. They've always been, but there's more coming out, which is so exciting for me.
And Durban.
See, Durban is interesting. I feel I wanted to really write a novel set in Durban because nobody was writing enough about Durban and we weren't getting enough stories from Durban. We were, but not the way Johannesburg and Cape Town were being profiled. And I don't like this sense of like people always think it's so terrible in Durban and people are leaving Durban. And that is true. I'm not going to say that things are not bad in Durban. But in the process of that, people are also forgetting that there's a magic in Durban and that there's a sense of a beauty in the city. And that's getting lost completely. We're forgetting about it. And there's so much there still to offer. So I wanted to write a novel that shows you Durban in that special way. You know, the heat and the lushness and the humidity and the tropics, and it's such a special place. And I wanted to, as a writer, I think if you're stuck in a place like that, because I do feel stuck sometimes, then it's your duty to capture it and write about it and make people remember. That's the point of writing, also make people remember what a place is about. Yeah,
there are various mothers in The Lost Love. There's Mina's mother, who's a warm and nurturing presence. There's Sana's mother, who she experiences as sort of quite cold and distant and intellectual, even though we learn she does love her family. There's Jahanara, who sort of, when she's distracted, chooses to give her children no attention whatsoever or else dote on them. There's Mina herself as a mother, who we get to see perform in a very vivid fashion. Do you believe that there are many ways to be a good mother? Is that something you're interested in showing in your story?
Yeah, I think that's why I have such a diversity of mothers in the novel, to show you that I think, you know, motherhood must be such a complicated thing. And that even though Sana's mother doesn't give her love in the traditional sense in the novel, and she's described as like an unmothered daughter in the beginning of the novel, by the end, Sana realizes that maybe her mother did love her in her own way. Mm. It was just not the way that we were taught. And sometimes we're taught that love is supposed to be a particular kind of language. But as time goes by, you realize love is a very complicated language and it comes out in different ways. And so, I don't know, I've been to book clubs where some women have told me, oh my God, she was a terrible mother. Oh, how could she do that to her child? How could she leave her in the bath alone and just go off and walk in the field? Like, what kind of mother was she? But I also think mothers they're women. And women are, you know, there's so much of depth there. Like, the father describes it to her and says she was like a flower in the field, and I picked her up and I put her in a vase in the house. And I don't know if she wanted to be there. Mm. She was trying to do the best that she could do with what she had. And I think everybody's doing that. They're trying to do the best that they can do with what they have. And so I think that's what I was showing or trying to show by having so many different types of mothers in the novel.
You've mentioned book clubs there, and it seems to be a rising thing in the writing promotion community. I haven't done much of it, so I'm very interested in it, that engaging with book clubs. Is that something you've done a lot, and how has it enriched your writing?
I haven't done it a lot. I did one in Durban, which I did. They were the original book club who invited me in Durban, like when Onion Tears came out. And it was nice after 13 years to see everybody was still together and doing the book club. I think they're fun. They're fun for me in the sense when I don't have to answer questions. I just love to listen to hear what other people thought. And I love when it becomes a debate. So like the one was like, oh my God. And I never thought of this. She was like, that house must be so smelly. She was like, you know, she was like, they don't wash the dishes and they put it in the cupboards.
That bagged me.
She's like, that house must be so smelly and dirty. And I never thought of it as a writer. And then one lady was like, but what was it about Meena that Akbar loved? Was she very voluptuous? Like, in my imagination, she must have been very voluptuous and she must have been very beautiful that he was, because why would he be interested in her? And they were having a debate among themselves. And I just love to watch when people are having a debate about something you wrote and their interpretation of it. That's what I love about a book club, is just like watching what other people thought about the novel. I actually don't like answering the questions because then I break the bubble that they've built up for themselves. And I feel like I break the magic. I pull the curtain back on the workings that they would never normally know. So I love being at book clubs just to listen to what people are saying. And I try not to answer too many questions.
Very interesting.
So just as we are writers and creators, we also are consumers of content. So we always like to ask our guests what they have been reading or watching or listening to lately that's made an impression on them.
I have not been watching anything lately just because of all the travel, but I really loved Past Lives. I saw it recently. It's a movie that came out with South Korean American actors, just like a lot of awards that it's received. And I was waiting for it to come out because I really thought like it explored love in a very interesting way. If you haven't seen it, you must see it. It's about a young Korean girl who moves to America. And she leaves her childhood love behind. And then she marries an American man and she's living a very American life. And he contacts her, the young Korean man contacts after years. They must be in their mid-30s by then. And he's like, do you remember me? And immediately there's this thing of like, they were meant to be with one another, you know, and he comes to America. He can't speak the language properly. It's a strange country for him. And the husband acknowledges him and says, if things had turned out the other way, you and my wife would have ended up together, you know. It's done in a very delicate, beautiful way. And I really loved it. And it was the perfect ending I've ever seen in a long time. The most perfect ending. Mm. So that is what I watched recently and I loved. And I'm also reading Lydia Davis. I love Lydia Davis's because she does these really short pieces of fiction. Mm-hmm. And I think they just take you into like a little world and take you into a little world. I can't remember what's her new title, but I've got it on my bedside. And Sven's Axelrod's God's Pocket just came out, and I've just finished reading that, and it's amazing. It's really good. It's about a young man. It's very autobiographical, but he'll say it's fiction, about a young man who's an accountant, which is also Sven, who goes away to a cabin to write a novel. The author of the book that he's writing is Sven Axelrod. So it's very meta.
Yes.
It's very meta, but very funny. And it's such a great book. Yeah.
I'm in the middle of it.
Okay, good.
And that moment where he says, and what are you going to name the character? And then the character goes, well, I want it to be exotic, so I'm going to name him Sven Axelrod. And I was,
it's so funny. It's funny. It's good.
I'm looking forward to getting into that one because I did read Buried Treasure and we had Sven on the pod, and I'm looking forward to the second one. So Shabnam, thank you so much for your time. We hope that everybody will read Onion Tears, which has been re-released as a paperback. And I hope they will search for your modern love story and look up your book of essays. And most importantly, get the critically acclaimed The Lost Love of Akbar Manzil, which is a fantastic novel. I hope everyone checks it out. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure to be able to talk to you both.
Thank you. Gail Shabnam was every bit as interesting as we were expecting, and I'm sure our listeners would agree. Wasn't that a great conversation?
You know, everyone in the writing community tells you how lovely she is. I had not met her before, and really, she is just so lovely.
What in particular did you get from her?
So I loved, absolutely loved what she said about recipes and cooking as a love language.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it, like for so many of us, you know, our mothers maybe didn't know how to say I love you with words. I don't know that my mother ever said I love you with words, and she was not physically affectionate, but she fed me. Mm-hmm. And she passed on her cooking to me, and she passed on in a very physical way her recipe books to me. And it's, I've realized very recently how much cooking for my family is my love language to them. If somebody cooks for me, which happens very seldom, when someone cooks for me, I really do receive it as a message of love. So I was fascinated by that. What about you?
I was interested in what she said about advocating for yourself as a writer and investing in yourself and not being afraid to put yourself forward for something, even if you think there's no chance you're going to get it. And I know that this is something, for example, that Lauren Bierkes did early in her career. Just invest that money, go to something that seems like a wild card chance somewhere in the world, and amazingly good things might flow from it. And I know not everybody has the resources, but there are different ways of backing yourself and advocating for yourself that don't involve money. Just put yourself forward for things, even if you think you're never going to get them.
I always think it's important to remember the worst thing that can happen is somebody says no. And so what? If someone says no, you're right where you were when you started. You may as well ask.
You're right. You said that to me recently, and I thought, oh, but I'm so afraid of people saying no to me. It does feel like the worst thing that can happen. But it really isn't. You, life moves on. You recover from it, and you get on with things.
100%.
Gail, do you have any advice or problems for our readers to grapple with?
Yeah, Fiona, the advice. So my problem is that I feel a bit of a fraud giving advice at the moment. Mm-hmm. You'll notice last week I actually kind of chickened out of the giving advice. I gave other people's advice for my advice. I'm struggling with writing at the moment. I'm struggling to come back to it. I'm struggling to sit down and do it. So I don't feel like I'm in a position to be advising anyone. You know, I've been in the past quite judgmental. If you love something, you'll make space for it, I tell people.
Mm-hmm.
I still love writing, but I'm not making space for it.
And do you think this is a temporary thing, or you're hoping it's a temporary thing?
I'm hoping it's a temporary thing. I think we talk a lot about being kind to oneself. I'm going to be kind to myself till the end of this month.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to allow myself that this is a busy writing month in terms of other people's writing things. And I am going to let myself off the hook to a certain extent. And I will report back next month.
Fantastic.
What about you? What advice do you have for me, Fiona?
Well, I was talking earlier about how the writing was feeling a bit mechanical and uninspired and bitty. And I think that the solution came while we were talking to Shabnam, actually, because listening to another writer write about their process and their inspiration, it just fills something in me. It's a kind of form of refilling the well. I just find it so inspiring. I feel that love surging in me again. I feel as though I can now fall back in love with my writing, as though it is something worthy and I can give it my attention. And in the meantime, we are still taking in your questions about writing. We are looking forward to you getting in touch and telling us what you're struggling with in writing, and we'll do our best to help you get in touch. We're on all social media across the board, and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.